How it all began. Our nation's economic decay did not start with the Obama administration or even with the George W. Bush regime. Rather, it began decades earlier, in the early 20th century, with the founding of a privately owned banking syndicate known as the Federal Reserve System, a government-sanctioned cartel of private banks that was created in a conspiratorial manner and is under heavy criticism to this day, even being blamed for the current financial woes. Joan Vion, a businesswoman and international reporter who has covered more than 100 global conferences on financial and trade matters, wrote that the recent bailouts were simply the latest moves by the globalists to solidify their control over the United States. The bailout of Freddie and Fannie provided us with the latest excitement in the diabolical saga of the raping, robbing, and pillaging of America. Interestingly enough, it took place 13 months after the beginning of the credit crunch. It was planned and managed destruction in order to accomplish the final transfer of America's financial sovereignty, she noted. Former Secretary of Housing Catherine Austin Fitz agreed, stating that in the attempt to build a global American-run military empire, trillions of dollars have been shifted out of the United States by both legal and illegal means to reinvest in Asia and emerging markets through taxpayer bailout money, coupled with Fed loans to foreign banks. In doing so, she said, we have left economic sovereignty behind. Finally, the expense and corruption of empire resulted in bailouts of $12 to $14 trillion, delivering a new financial war chest to the people leading the financial engineering, the globalists. Now we have exploding unemployment, an exploding federal deficit, an inspector general for the TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, bailout program predicting that the ultimate bailout cost could rise to $23.7 trillion, said Fitz. With this lost money came lost jobs. Unemployment figures are usually a good gauge of the nation's economy. In mid-2009, unemployment was officially 9.4%. If for some reason this number seems low, one must note that these numbers do not include those who would like a job but have stopped looking, so-called discouraged workers, and those who are working fewer hours than they want, said Dennis Lockhart, president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. With these numbers included, the unemployment rate would move from the official 9.4% to 16%. As 2010 progressed, so did the unemployment figures, which began to match the numbers of the Great Depression. Yet, unlike the 1930s, money was still available, and money is the lifeblood of a zombie nation. The trappings of wealth and bankers' lifestyles are often admired by outsiders with a fervency bordering on religious, yet only those who live these lifestyles understand the inner workings of the money cult, and they work hard to keep these inner workings secret. Consider the 1966 essay, Gold and Economic Freedom, by Alan Greenspan, who from 1987 to 2006 was chairman of the Fed. Greenspan wrote, "Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the hidden confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. It stands as a protector of property rights. If one grasps this, one has no difficulty in understanding the statists' antagonism toward the gold standard. In other words, spending paper money you don't have runs up debt that, with interest due, earns much more than the original debt, especially if it is not repaid promptly. This is the hidden confiscation of wealth. Paper money can be devalued, but a gold piece will always retain some value and is therefore a good hedge against both inflation and devaluation, which is why the globalists seeking a strong central authority, statists, are generally opposed to a gold standard, because it robs them of the means of robbing the public through high interest rates, service charges, late payments, and monetary exchanges. following a talk by Greenspan at the Economic Club of New York in 1993, Dr. Lawrence Parks, the executive director of the Foundation for the Advancement of Monetary Education, FAME, approached the Fed chairman and asked if he still agreed with his 1966 conclusions on deficit spending and gold. "Absolutely," Greenspan responded. Parks then asked why Greenspan did not speak out about his knowledge, and the response was, "Some of my colleagues at the institution I represent, the Fed, do not agree with me." Whether Greenspan was fibbing or he was mistaken about his colleagues, the Fed actually shared Greenspan's opinion on gold. They just didn't want the public to know. The nonprofit Gold Antitrust Action Committee Incorporated, or GATA, was organized in 1999 to oppose the illegal collusion over the price and supply of gold and related financial securities. According to the committee, in 2009, the Federal Reserve System disclosed to Congress that it had made gold swap arrangements with foreign banks, but it does not want the public to know about them. This disclosure directly contradicted the Fed's earlier denials of making gold swaps to GATA back in 2001. A GATA news release also suggested that the Fed was indeed very much involved in the surreptitious international central bank manipulation of the gold price particularly and the currency markets generally. Earlier in 2009, GATA sought information on current gold swaps, a practice denied by Alan Greenspan, then Fed chairman, back in 1995. But this question was rebuffed by the Fed, which claimed this information was exempt from Freedom of Information Act requests. GATA appealed to the Fed's board, but in a September 2009 letter to GATA's lawyer, Federal Reserve Board member Kevin M. Warsh upheld the denial of information by stating, "In connection with your appeal, I have confirmed that the information withheld under Exemption 4 consists of confidential commercial or financial information relating to the operations of the Federal Reserve Banks that was obtained within the meaning of Exemption 4. This includes information relating to swap arrangements with foreign banks on behalf of the Federal Reserve System, and is not the type of information that is customarily disclosed to the public. This information was properly withheld from you." GATA claimed the letter was not the first admission of the Fed making gold swaps, but that it comes at a sensitive time in the currency and gold markets. According to a GATA news release, "The U.S. dollar is showing unprecedented weakness. The gold price is showing unprecedented strength. Western European central banks appear to be withdrawing from gold sales and leasing, and the International Monetary Fund is being pressed to take the lead in the gold price suppression scheme by selling gold from its own supposed reserves in the guise of providing financial support for poor nations." It is now expected that a lawsuit will be filed in federal court to appeal the Fed's denial of GATA's Freedom of Information request concerning gold swaps. Those people stocking up on gold for safekeeping might keep in mind that gold and silver, in fact, just about anything considered a financial asset, may be seized by federal authorities in wartime or any officially declared emergency. Those who hoard gold against the possible devaluation or collapse of the dollar might remember that during the Great Depression, the hoarding and use of gold as a medium of exchange was outlawed. According to the GATA website, "Government confiscation of gold has never been a serious or imminent threat, but in any emergency, this could swiftly change." While the U.S. government in 1933 did demand the exchange of circulating government-issued coins for paper money, proceeding to devalue the paper money after the gold was surrendered, that gold then was a huge part of the country's money supply. And amid the national economic collapse at that time, the government could make a plausible complaint against hoarding. There are no such circumstances today, gold no longer being in general circulation as currency, but of course lately the arrogance and imperiousness of the U.S. government have far exceeded even the paranoia of precious metals investors. Certainly capital controls may be imposed in the United States in the next currency crisis, and it's not far from capital controls to even more brutal interventions in the economy. Such concern intensified with the 2005 letter to GATA, in which the former chief counsel for the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, Sean M. Thornton, explained the scope of the government's power in making financial seizures. It took GATA 6 months and a little prodding to get answers from the Treasury, but the Treasury's reply, when it came, was remarkably comprehensive and candid. The government's authority to interfere with the ownership of gold, silver, and mining shares arises from the Trading with the Enemy Act, which became law in 1917 during World War I and applies during declared wars, and from 1977's International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which can be applied without declared wars. While the Trading with the Enemy Act authorizes the government to interfere with the ownership of gold and silver particularly, it also applies to all forms of currency and all securities. So the Treasury official stressed that it could be applied not just to shares of gold and silver mining companies, but to the shares of all companies in which there is a foreign ownership interest. Further, there is no requirement in the law that the targets of the government's interference must have some connection to the declared enemies of the United States, or really, some connection to foreign ownership. Anything that can be construed as a financial instrument, no matter how innocently it has been used, is subject to seizure under the Trading with the Enemy Act and the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Usury. Usury is a term that has all but disappeared from our language. Once, usury was defined as any interest charged for a loan, but modern dictionaries softened this definition to merely excessive interest. The Texas Constitution once defined usury as any interest in excess of 6%. This ceiling was increased over the years until the whole concept was deleted. Those who knew the Bible recall that Jesus was crucified by those in power for chasing money changers out of the temple. Public anger today is being directed at all the financial moguls of both Wall Street and Washington, D.C. Charging interest on pretended loans is usury, and that has become institutionalized under the Federal Reserve System, argued G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. This has been accomplished by masking the operations of the Fed in secrecy and arcane economic terms. The mechanism by which the Fed converts debt into money may seem complicated at first, but it is simple if one remembers that the process is not intended to be logical, but to confuse and deceive, Griffin added. Former Washington Post editor William Grider wrote, "The details of the Fed's actions were presumed to be too esoteric for ordinary citizens to understand." Some believe this ignorance may be a blessing. Henry Ford was quoted as saying, "It is well enough that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." "Most Americans have no real understanding of the operation of the international moneylenders," stated the late Senator Barry Goldwater. "The bankers want it that way. We recognize in a hazy sort of way that the Rothschilds and the Warburgs of Europe and the houses of J.P. Morgan, Kuhn, Loeb and Company, Schiff, Lehman and Rockefeller, possess and control vast wealth. How they acquire this vast financial power and employ it is a mystery to most of us. International bankers make money by extending credit to governments. The greater the debt of the political state, the larger the interest returned to the lenders. The national banks of Europe are actually owned and controlled by private interests. These same private interests now own and control the Federal Reserve System." Money for faith and debt. According to William Grider, the Fed has assumed a cult-like power. To modern minds, it seems bizarre to think of the Federal Reserve as a religious institution. Yet the conspiracy theorists, in their own demented way, were on to something real and significant. The Fed did also function in the realm of religion. Its mysterious powers of money creation, inherited from priestly forebearers, shielded a complex bundle of social and psychological meanings. With its own form of secret incantation, the Federal Reserve presided over awesome social ritual. Transactions so powerful and frightening they seemed to lie beyond common understanding. Above all, money was a function of faith. It required implicit and universal social consent that was indeed mysterious. To create money and use it, each one must believe and everyone must believe. Only then did worthless pieces of paper take on value. Money today is increasingly mere electronic blips on a computer, accessed by plastic cards at ATMs. There is nothing to back it up. As money is loaned at interest by great institutions, its worth decreases as more and more of it comes into existence. This is called inflation, which in some ways is a built-in tax on the use of money. And inflation can be manipulated upward or downward by those who control the flow of money, whether it be through paper or the electronic blips. The result of this whole system is massive debt at every level of society today, wrote author William Bramley. The banks are in debt to the depositors, and the depositors' money is loaned out and creates indebtedness to the banks, making this system even more akin to something out of a maniac's delirium. Is the fact that banks, like other lenders, often have the right to seize physical property if its paper money is not repaid. The Federal Reserve Anomaly. In America, the bankers of the Federal Reserve System have the greatest control of the nation's money. Because the Fed is at the center of U.S. monetary policy control, it has become the central bank of the United States. By changing the supply of money in circulation, the Fed influences interest rates, which in turn affects millions of families' mortgage payments. It also can cause financial markets to boom or collapse, and the economy to expand or contract into recession. The Fed is the crucial anomaly at the very core of representative democracy, an uncomfortable contradiction with the civic mythology of self-government, wrote William Grider. His 1987 book, Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country, disparages nativist conspiracy theories, yet presents an eloquent conspiracy argument for the Fed's control. Consider that a paper bill is simply a promissory note to be traded at some point for something of value. It thus makes sense to perceive paper money as valuable as real goods or services. This viewpoint worked well before the invention of interest. The early goldsmiths in Europe who warehoused gold coins used their stockpiles as the basis for issuing paper money, since it was highly unlikely that everyone would demand their gold back at the same time. The smiths became bankers, loaning out a portion of their stockpile at interest for profit. This practice, loaning the greater portion of wealth while retaining only a small fraction for emergencies, became known as fractional reserve or fractional banking. This system worked well until everyone suddenly wanted their deposits back and started a run on the bank. Bank runs, or depositors demanding their money back all at one time, were a major cause of financial damage during the Great Depression of the 1930s. But runs are not just history. In early 2008, Northern Rock Bank, the fifth largest bank in the United Kingdom, was nationalized by the government due to financial problems created by the subprime mortgage crisis and a run on its branch banks. After the invention of fractional banking came the implementation of fiat money, intrinsically worthless paper money made valuable by law or decree of government. An early example of this system was recorded by Marco Polo during his visit to China in 1275. Polo noted the emperor forced his people to accept black pieces of paper with an official seal on them as legal money under pain of imprisonment or death. The emperor then used his fiat money to pay all his foreign debts. One is tempted to marvel at the emperor's audacious power and the subservience of his subjects who endured such an outrage, wrote G. Edward Griffin. But our smugness rapidly vanishes when we consider the similarity of our own Federal Reserve notes. They are adorned with signatures and seals. Counterfeiters are severely punished. The government pays its expenses with them. The population is forced to accept them. They, and the invisible checkbook money into which they can be converted, are made in such vast quantity that it must be equal in amount to all the treasures of the world. And yet, they cost nothing to make. In truth, our present monetary system is an almost exact replica of that which supported the warlords of 7 centuries ago. Nowhere was the art of making money out of money more developed than in the ancient Khazar Empire, which evolved from nomadic raider clans operating in the east-west caravan routes in the Caucasus mountain region north of Iraq and between the Black Sea and Caspian Sea. By the 10th century, the Khazars had created a wealthy empire that stretched from north of the Black Sea to the Ural Mountains and west of the Caspian Sea to the Dnieper River. The warlords of the Khazars thought that exchanging and loaning money would be more profitable and less hazardous than raiding caravans. There was one problem. The Khazar Empire was almost evenly divided among Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Both Christians and Muslims believed that charging interest on a loan, then called usury, was a sin. Only Jews could openly charge interest on loans. Whether they did it out of pragmatism or actual religiosity, the Khazar aristocrats professed a conversion to Judaism. According to the Random House Encyclopedia, some scholars believe they, the Khazars, are the progenitors of many Eastern European Jews. This would include the renowned Rothschild family, who financially ruled Europe for more than a century. Conspiracy researchers claim they still dominate the world financial order and have been the financial backers of the Rockefellers and other wealthy families. It might be noted that none of these converted Khazarians had any connection whatsoever to Palestine, yet these were among the Russian progenitors of the political movement known as Zionism. The 1917 Balfour Declaration, a statement by British Foreign Secretary Alfred Balfour that guaranteed a Jewish home in Palestine and was later approved as a mandate by the League of Nations, is acknowledged as the foundation for the creation of the State of Israel. This letter originally was a reply to a leading Zionist, Baron Walter Rothschild, the first unconverted Jewish peer in England's House of Lords. The money management methods of the Rothschild banking dynasty have been emulated for decades by the globalist financiers, whether Jewish or otherwise. One key component of this management is secrecy. Utilizing bought-off politicians who catch the public rage and scrutiny, major globalists are able to operate out of the public eye almost with impunity. Derek Wilson, who chronicled the Rothschild Empire in his 1988 book, Rothschild, The Wealth and Power of a Dynasty, wrote, "Even when in later years some of them, the Rothschilds, entered Parliament, they did not feature prominently in the assembly chambers of London, Paris, or Berlin. Yet all the while they were helping to shape the major events of the day, by granting or withholding funds, by providing statesmen with an official diplomatic service, by influencing appointments to high office, and by an almost daily intercourse with the great decision-makers." The invention of the printing press, which allowed for the printing of paper money as well as the Bible, led to the Age of Enlightenment and the decline of the Roman Church. Money replaced religion as the new control mechanism of the wealthy elite. And despite the popular myth, the American colonial revolt against England occurred more over concern for its own currency than a small tax on tea. Benjamin Franklin wrote, "The inability of the colonists to get the power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War." As previously discussed, wealth equals power, and the American revolutionists knew that to gain true freedom, they had to break the power of the Rothschild-dominated Bank of England, which had outlawed their money, colonial script. Once America's freedom was secured, Founding Fathers Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton began arguing over whether or not to adopt a central bank. Hamilton believed in a strong central government with a central bank overseen by a wealthy elite. No society could succeed which did not unite the interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state, Hamilton wrote. Supporters of Hamilton's elitism formed America's first political party, the Federalists. Hamilton, once described as a tool of the international bankers, argued that a national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be a powerful cement to our nation. It will also create a necessity for keeping up taxation to a degree which, without being oppressive, will be a spur to industry. America's first central bank, the Bank of North America, was created in 1781 by Continental Congressman Robert Morris, who modeled the bank after the Bank of England. The bank was formed before the Constitution was drafted and was wrought with fraud and plagued with inflation caused by the creation of baseless fiat currency. The bank lasted for 3 years. Morris's former aide, Alexander Hamilton, became Secretary of the Treasury and in 1791 headed the next attempt at a central bank by establishing the First Bank of the United States. He was strongly opposed by Jefferson and his followers. In 1811, the charter of the First Bank of the United States was not renewed. Jefferson knew from British and European history that a central bank trading on interest could quickly become the master of a nation, noting to John Taylor in 1816 that the other nations of Europe have tried and trodden every path of force or folly in fruitless quest of the same object. Yet we still expect to find in juggling tricks and banking dreams that money can be made out of nothing. Banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Jefferson added, "Already they have raised up a money aristocracy. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs." Jefferson believed that instituting a central bank would be unconstitutional. "I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, enshrined in the 10th Amendment, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and the powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the United States by the Constitution." Despite Jefferson's lobbying, the financial chaos that resulted from the War of 1812 prompted Congress to issue a 20-year charter to the Second Bank of the United States in 1816. Andrew Jackson, the first president from west of the Appalachian Mountains, denounced the central bank as unconstitutional and a curse to a republic inasmuch as it is calculated to raise around the administration a moneyed aristocracy dangerous to the liberties of the country. This central bank ended in 1836, after President Jackson vetoed a congressional bill to extend its charter. Much to bankers' dismay, Jackson fully eliminated the national debt by the end of his 2 terms as president. It was probably no coincidence that America's first assassination attempt was made on Jackson by a man named Richard Lawrence, a man who claimed to be in touch with the powers in Europe, who had promised to intervene if any attempt was made to punish him. Lawrence was a painter, and many speculate that at the time the lead in his paints had caused him to become mentally unbalanced and fancy himself the rightful king of England. After stalking Jackson for several weeks, on January 30, 1835, a particularly humid day, he approached the president coming from a funeral. Stepping suddenly from behind a pillar, Lawrence pulled 2 pistols, but both misfired, most likely due to damp powder. Lawrence was swiftly wrestled to the ground by onlookers, including Congressman Davy Crockett, aided by Jackson. At his trial, Lawrence was prosecuted by Francis Scott Key, the author of The Star-Spangled Banner. The jury took only 5 minutes to find Lawrence insane, and he spent the rest of his life in mental institutions, dying in 1861. Although many persons, including Jackson, believed Lawrence was part of a larger conspiracy, at the time there was no evidence to prove whether he was merely a lone nut assassin or an early-day patsy somehow manipulated into attacking Jackson, an implacable enemy of the international bankers. However, it might be worth noting that in two successful presidential assassinations, those of Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy, both men were attempting to thwart the international bankers. Lincoln by issuing his own money, greenbacks, and Kennedy in bypassing the Fed with his U.S. notes in 1963. While most people understand what took place when the American Revolution was fought, many are not aware of the permanent financial revolution that was being fought over the world's monetary system since 1694 when the Bank of England was created, explained international reporter Joan Vion. At that time, a group of private individuals decided that they could make a great deal of money if they changed the laws of the land to shift control of the country's finances from the government to them. The Bank of England, which is England's central bank, is a private corporation which earns a continuous stream of income when the British government borrows from them to run the country. England was the ingenious country that recognized that they could run the world's finances if they established private corporations in all the countries of the world. The combined debt of all the world's countries would create an income stream of unbelievable amounts. In 1913, Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act, creating our central bank. Most Americans don't know that this organization is a private corporation established to control America's monetary system through the banking industry. Other attempts were made to resurrect a central bank in America, but none succeeded until the creation of the Federal Reserve System at the hands of a well-documented conspiracy. The situation we are confronted with did not happen in the last few years, but began in 1913 when a group of cunningly deceitful legislators passed the Federal Reserve Act on December 24th at 11:45 p.m. after those who were opposed went home for Christmas, Beyond noted. There was an occasion near the close of 1910 when I was as secretive indeed, as furtive as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System, wrote Frank A. Vanderlip, one of the men who created the Fed. He went on to become president of New York's National City Bank, a forebearer of today's Citibank. What Vanderlip was referring to was a secretive trip on the night of November 22, 1910, by seven men who perhaps held as much as one-fourth of the world's wealth. Jekyll Island was J.P. Morgan's fashionable hunting retreat off the coast of Georgia, and the men went under secrecy so strict that they only used first names when addressing one another and brought in new servants who were unaware of their identities. During their week on Jekyll Island, the men worked on a plan for a banking reform that the government deemed necessary after a series of financial panics in 1879, 1893, and 1907. In fact, Princeton University president and future U.S. president Woodrow Wilson proclaimed that the solution to the financial panics laid in the appointment of a committee of six or seven public-spirited men like J.P. Morgan to handle the affairs of our country. Cries arose for a stable national system that could regulate banking and prevent crises and panics. Today, many researchers believe these panics were artificially created as a pretext for the reforms. The seven men were Vanderlip, who represented William Rockefeller and Jacob Schiff's investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company; Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Abraham Piot Andrew; Senior Partner of J.P. Morgan Company Henry P. Davidson; First National Bank of New York, a Morgan-dominated institution, President Charles D. Norton; Morgan Lieutenant Benjamin Strong; Kuhn, Loeb and Company partner Paul Moritz Warburg, and Rhode Island Republican Senator Nelson W. Aldrich. Though Aldrich was not technically a banker, he was an associate of J.P. Morgan. He was also the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Paul Warburg, an original funder of the Council on Foreign Relations, was the brother of Max Warburg, chief of the M.M. Warburg Company banking consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. In just a few years, Max Warburg would aid Lenin in crossing wartime Germany to found communism in Russia. It must also be noted that Senator Aldrich was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, charged with stabilizing the U.S. monetary system. Aldrich and his commission toured Europe at taxpayer expense and consulted with the top central banks of England, France, and Germany, which were all dominated by the Rothschilds. After spending $300,000 of tax dollars, the commission subsequently released a 38-volume history of European banking, focusing on the German Reichsbank, whose principal stockholders were the Rothschilds and M.M. Warburg Company. The National Monetary Commission's final report was prepared by the very men who had secretly journeyed to Morgan's Jekyll Island Hunt Club, ostensibly to hunt ducks. These men concluded that having one central bank in the United States was insufficient. Rather, several would be needed, and they would have to be operated under the auspices of what would look like an official agency of the U.S. government. They also agreed that no one was to utter the words central or bank, a pact that held up well. The Fed was never publicly referred to as the central bank until well into the 1980s, when the term was no longer as loaded. Speaking before the American Bankers Association, Aldrich stated, "The organization proposed is not a bank, but a cooperative union of all the banks of the country for definite purposes." Paul Warburg had conceived of constructing a cooperative banking union in which restrictions on the banker would be removed in a manner palatable to both the bankers and the public. But too many people saw the Aldrich plan as a transparent attempt to create a system by the bankers and for the bankers. "The Aldrich plan is the Wall Street plan," warned Representative Charles A. Lindbergh, father of the famed aviator. When Aldrich proposed his plan as a bill, it never got out of committee. Aldrich needed a new tactic. It came by way of the House Banking and Currency Committee chairman, Representative Carter Glass of Virginia, who attacked the Aldrich plan by openly stating it lacked government control and created a banking monopoly. Glass drafted an alternative, the Federal Reserve Act. Jekyll Island planners, Vanderlip and Aldrich, spoke out venomously against Glass's bill, even though entire sections of the bill were identical to the Aldrich plan. By putting on a front of banker opposition, Aldrich and Vanderlip ingeniously garnered public support for the Glass bill in the major newspapers. Meanwhile, another tactic was being played out in the political arena, dethroning the president. President William Howard Taft was already on the record pledging to veto any legislation creating a central bank. A more compliant leader was needed by the bankers. This leader was Woodrow Wilson, the academic who had been retained as president of Princeton University by his former classmates Cleveland H. Dodd and Cyrus McCormick, Jr., both directors of Rockefeller's National City Bank of New York. For nearly 20 years before his nomination, Woodrow Wilson had moved in the shadow of Wall Street, wrote author Ferdinand Lundberg. Wilson, who had praised J.P. Morgan in 1907, had been made governor of New Jersey. With the approval of the nation's bankers, Wilson's nomination for president was secured by Colonel Edward Mandel House, a close associate of Warburg and Morgan. House would go on to become Wilson's constant companion and advisor. The Schiffs, the Warburgs, the Kahns, the Rockefellers, and the Morgans all had faith in House, noted Professor Charles Seymour, who edited House's papers. But there was a problem. Early polling indicated that the Democrat Wilson could not defeat the Republican Taft. in a political maneuver that has been used successfully several times since. Former President Theodore Teddy Roosevelt, also a Republican, was encouraged to run as a third-party candidate. Large sums of money were provided to his Progressive Party by two major contributors closely connected to J.P. Morgan. The maneuver worked as well with the 1912 campaign as it would with the subsequent campaigns of George Wallace, John B. Anderson, Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, and Chuck Baldwin. Roosevelt pulled enough votes away from Taft for Wilson to be elected by a narrow margin. Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act on December 23, 1913. The same day, the House Senate Conference Committee had passed it along, and the day before Christmas Eve. Congress was already home, and the average citizen's attention was focused on the holidays. Congress was outflanked, outfoxed, and outclassed by a deceptive but brilliant psychopolitical attack, commented G. Edward Griffin. Today, the Federal Reserve System is composed of 12 Federal Reserve banks that operate under the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Each serves a different section of the country. These banks are administered by a board of governors, which is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. The confirmation is usually a rubber stamp procedure. As previously noted, the current chairman of the Fed's board of governors is Ben Shalom Bernanke, who succeeded Alan Greenspan in 2006 and was renamed chairman by President Obama in August 2009. In 2008, Bernanke was photographed leaving the yearly meeting of that secretive globalist group known as the Bilderbergers, see Jim Marr's Rule by Secrecy for the History of the Bilderbergs, in Chantilly, Virginia. Also on the Board of Governors is Daniel Tarullo, a Georgetown law professor who specializes in international economic regulation, banking law, and international law, and who has served as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. The youngest governor in the history of the board is Kevin Maxwell Warsh, a vice president of Morgan Stanley, who was age 35 at his appointment in February 2006. Warsh was trained as a lawyer, not as an economist. Today, most people recognize that the Fed is a pivotal force in the world economy, but few understand who controls it and why. It is a private organization owned by its member banks, which are owned by private stockholders. And who are these stockholders? An examination of the major stockholders of the New York City Bank shows clearly that a few families, related by blood, marriage, or business interests, still control the New York City banks, which in turn hold the controlling stock of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, wrote Eustace Mullins. In his 1983 book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, Mullins presented charts connecting the Fed and its member banks to the families of the Rothschilds, Morgans, Rockefellers, Warburgs, and others. It is interesting to note that those who sit at the very top of the corporate, academic, and labor power hierarchy are listed as 2009 directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This list includes James Dimon, chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, Charles V. Waite, president, CEO, and chairman of the Adirondack Trust Company of Saratoga Springs, New York, Jeffrey R. Immelt, chairman and CEO of General Electric Company, Fairfield, Connecticut, Lee C. Bollinger, president of Columbia University, Catherine S. Wilde, president and CEO of Partnership for New York City, and board chairman Dennis M. Hughes, president of the New York State AFL-CIO. Some suspicious researchers have speculated on why so many secret society members, Greenspan, Bernanke, Tarullo, all members of the CFR, and attorneys are needed to supervise the U.S. monetary system. It might be that bankers need their legal expertise. According to early conspiracy researcher and author Gary Allen, using a central bank to create alternate periods of inflation and deflation, and thus whipsawing the public for vast profits, had been worked out by the international bankers, aided by legal and public opinion experts, to an exact science. In 1913, Congressman Charles A. Lindbergh said that the Federal Reserve System establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this act, the invisible government by the money power will be legitimized. The new law will create inflation whenever the trusts want inflation. From now on, depressions will be scientifically created, he warned. Most Americans understand that the Fed controls our money system, but they believe it's part of our government, as would be expected of any organization holding that much power over the destiny of our country, explained Stephen Zarlenga, director of the American Monetary Institute in New York State. Americans also erroneously believe the banking business consists of accepting deposits from clients and then reloaning them to borrowers at a higher rate of interest. Though the number is definitely growing, most Americans have no idea that money, or more accurately, interest-bearing bank credits acting as a purchasing media which serves as money, is created by the banking system when loans are made through the fractional reserve provisions. This is understood by few novices, and often economists and even bankers fail to comprehend that they function as part of a money creation system when they issue credits and deposit them into their clients' accounts when loans are extended. Therefore, most Americans would be surprised to learn that almost all of what we use for money is not issued by our government, but by private banks. They have been allowed to form erroneous assumptions about our money and banking system that are far from reality, and that serves to shield from closer scrutiny, from questions such as whether the Fed is truly operating in the public interest or advancing more private agendas, either on purpose or by default. Bruce Wiseman, president of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights and former chairman of the History Department at John F. Kennedy University, explained the Fed's operations. When the Fed prints the money or clicks the mouse, they have no money themselves. They are just creating it out of thin air. They just print it or send it digitally. And then they charge interest on the money they lent to the Treasury. A $100 bill costs 4 cents to print, but the interest is charged on the $100. Go ahead, listen again. The words won't change. The interest on the national debt last year, 2008, was $451,154,049,950.63. That's $1.23 billion a day. These are the same people that are now running our banks, insurance companies, and automobile manufacturers. Reason weeps. Sure, I oversimplified it. The Fed doesn't own all the debt, and they do some other things. But these are the basics. That is how a central bank works. Wiseman and many others believe the goal of the current financial crisis is to destroy the U.S. dollar as the currency of world finance and, in the resulting chaos, put in its place a globalist-run monetary authority that pledges such a crisis shall not happen again. Financial Stability Board. The global financial authority Wiseman alluded to may be found in the Financial Stability Board, or FSB, created in April 2009 during the G20 London Summit. The acronym G20 refers to the group of 20 finance ministers and central bank governors from 19 nations and the European Union. The FSB includes representatives from all G20 nations. The FSB evolved from the Financial Stability Forum, or FSF, which was established in 1999 as a group within the Bank for International Settlements to promote international financial stability. It is clear now that the forum's agenda of stability did not work out so well. Following the G20 London summit, this group expanded from the Discussion Group Forum, FSF, to a policymaking board, FSB, that can set standards, policies, and regulations, and then pass them on to the respective nations. Today, the FSB is made up of central bankers from Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, Singapore, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, and the United States, plus representatives of the World Bank, the European Union, the IMF, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. Europe, in other words, has 6 of the 12 national members. It has been noted that the G20 will enlarge the FSB to include all its member nations. However, observers see a definite pro-European bias. The United States will have one vote, equal to that of Italy. The governor of Italy's central bank, Mario Draghi, chairs the FSB and is former executive director of the World Bank. Like former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Draghi is a former executive with Goldman Sachs. Both Paulson and Draghi left the global investment firm in 2006 when Paulson went to Washington to head up the Treasury, and Draghi went to Rome to oversee Italy's financial system and the FSF. America's commitment to the FSB was made on April 2, 2009, when President Obama signed the G20 communique in London and announced America's agreement to the new global economic union. Henceforth, our SEC, or Securities and Exchange Commission, Commodities Trading Commission, Federal Reserve Board, and other regulators will have to march to the beat of drums pounded by the Financial Stability Board, a body of central bankers from each of the G20 states and the European Union, warned Dick Morris, best-selling author and former advisor to President Clinton. The Europeans have been trying to get their hands on our financial system for decades. It is essential to them that they rein in American free enterprise so that their socialist heaven will not be polluted by vices such as the profit motive. Now, with President Obama's approval, they have done it. Morris also opined on the FSB's ability for implementing tough new principles on pay and compensation and to support sustainable compensation schemes and the corporate social responsibility of all firms. That means that the FSB will regulate how much executives are to be paid and will enforce its idea of corporate social responsibility at all firms. Bruce Wiseman interprets President Barack Obama's signing of the United States into the FSB as essentially turning over the financial control of the country and the planet to a handful of central bankers who, besides dictating policy covering everything from your retirement income to shareholder rights, will additionally have access to your health and education records. Although the Fed is technically owned through shares held by its 12 regional banks, these banks are entirely owned by the private member banks within their respective districts. And who controls these banks? Their investors, many of whom may not even be Americans. Stephen Zarlenga argues that there may not even be reason for concern here, however. Stories that the Federal Reserve is owned by foreign bankers are not accurate, and these types of rumors have mainly served to discredit wholesome criticism of the banking system. The control of the Federal Reserve System is more difficult to untangle and is not just a matter of counting shareholder votes. While foreign bankers might indirectly own shares of the regional Federal Reserve banks through ownership of American banking companies, such ownership would be reported to the SEC if any entity held more than 5% of the American corporation. But, according to Zarlenga, there is one significant caveat. The strong, potentially undue foreign influence, for example, through the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS. Bringing the BIS into the financial mix is cause for further concern. Into Abyss. In a 2003 article titled "Controlling the World's Monetary System, the Bank for International Settlements," Joan Vian noted that the BIS is where all of the world's central banks meet to analyze the global economy and determine what course of action they will take next to put more money in their pockets, since they control the amount of money in circulation and how much interest they are going to charge governments and banks for borrowing from them. When you understand that the BIS pulls the strings of the world's monetary system, you then understand that they have the ability to create a financial boom or bust in a country. If that country is not doing what the money lenders want, then all they have to do is sell its currency. The BIS has even seemed to be cryptically signaling that it may try to exert more global financial control. In September 2009, a BIS report stated, "The global market for derivatives rebounded to $426 trillion in the second quarter of 2009 as risk appetite returned, but the system remains unstable and prone to crises." Within days of this report, the former chief economist for the BIS, William White, warned that the world has not tackled the problems at the heart of the economic downturn and is likely to slip back into recession. He added, "The only thing that would really surprise me is a rapid and sustainable recovery from the position we're in." Considering the growing power of the BIS over the U.S. economy and the bank's Nazi history, BIS developments should be of serious concern to all Americans. It deserves much closer scrutiny than that provided by the corporate mass media. For one, the public should be aware that the BIS is essentially a sovereign state. Its personnel have diplomatic immunity for their persons and papers. No taxes are levied on the bank or the personnel's salaries. The grounds on which BIS offices sit are sovereign, as are the buildings and offices. No government has legal jurisdiction over the bank, nor do any governments have oversight over its operations. It should also be noted that the BIS was originally owned in part by the Fed. The Morgan-affiliated First National Bank of New York, the Bank of England, Germany's Reichsbank, the Bank of Italy, the Bank of France, and other major central banks. The BIS, considered a central banker's bank, was created in 1930 in Basel, Switzerland, ostensibly to handle German war reparations. The BIS was also heavily manipulated by secret societies. According to Carol Quigley, a historian and a mentor to former President Bill Clinton, it was part of a plan to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole, to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The BIS continued to control the finances between Germany and the Allied nations throughout World War II. According to Quigley, the BIS was administered by a multinational staff and was considered the apex of the system of bankers who secretly exchanged information and planning during World War II. Even worse, by the start of the war, the BIS was under total Nazi control. According to the bank's charter, which was agreed to by the governments that formed the bank was immune from seizure, closure, or censure, even if its owners were at war. The BIS bank soon turned out to be a money funnel for American and British funds to flow into Hitler's coffers and to help Hitler build his war machine, stated author Charles Higham. "Over the years, I have watched as the BIS has continued to push the envelope further in a borderless world," wrote Joan Vian. "Some of their growing powers have come directly from governments like ours that have transferred the regulatory power they used to have over the banking system to the central bank, while the rest comes from the simple fact that they do indeed control the monetary system of the world." Vian, who had occasion to visit BIS headquarters, believes the bank has gained more power in global finance than most people know. This power stems from the BIS's very powerful committees, which include the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which has been working on how to regulate not only international banks of the world, but eventually every national bank as well. The Committee on the Global Financial System, which monitors financial markets around the world with the objective of identifying potential risks for financial stability. And the Committee on Payment and Settlement Systems, which looks to strengthen the infrastructure of financial markets with regard to rules on how to transfer monies and how to make payments between member banks. The Wall Street Journal reported on a 2003 meeting which included economist Dr. Jakob Frenkel, former U.S. Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, and Nobel laureate and Columbia economics professor Dr. Robert Mundell. Their theme was, "Does the global economy need a global currency?" The thesis was that if the euro can replace the franc, mark, and lira, why can't a new world currency merge the dollar, euro, and yen? I submit to you that this is the next agenda of the central bankers. When this change occurs, I can assure you they will make money on a new global currency. Time will tell if we do. The globalist bankers make money on each dollar they print because the American taxpayer is available to make up for any losses incurred. G. Edward Griffin quoted Paul Warburg, one of the founders of the Fed and its first chairman, as admitting, "While technically and legally the Federal Reserve note is an obligation of the United States government, in reality it is an obligation, the sole actual responsibility for which rests on the reserve banks. The government could only be called upon to take them up on their obligation after the reserve banks had failed." The man who masterminded the Federal Reserve System is telling us that Federal Reserve notes constitute privately issued money with the taxpayer standing by to cover the potential losses of those banks which issue it, Griffin explained. Again, we see a clear example of private profit but public debt. The Reserve Bank takes the profit while the taxpayers take the losses. Perhaps Jefferson and Lindbergh were right after all when they warned about private control over a central bank. With the creation of the Fed, the major bankers finally fulfilled a long-standing goal: taxpayer liability for the losses of private banks. Some have called it corporate socialism, whereby liabilities are assumed by the public treasury, but profits are for the private gain of the bank officers and investors. A taxpayer bailout was made manifest in the fall of 2008. The money that was used to cover government overspending and private corporation bailouts comes from a national income tax, which was invented by the same men who were behind creating the Fed. Sounding eerily like today's politicians, Wilson proclaimed his government was more concerned about human rights than about property rights. Using this rhetoric as a smokescreen, Wilson pushed through more progressive legislation than any previous American administration. He created the Internal Revenue Service of the Treasury Department to enforce a graduated income tax, the Federal Farm Loan Act, which created 12 banks for farmers, and the Federal Trade Commission to regulate business. To many people at the time, all of this legislation appeared necessary. Some still would argue that perhaps it is better that knowledgeable bankers be in charge of our nation's money supply. After all, a 1963 Federal Reserve publication states, "The function of the Federal Reserve is to foster a flow of money and credit that will facilitate orderly economic growth, a stable dollar, and long-run balance in our international payments." Attempts to audit the Fed. If the true functions of the Fed are to protect the nation's money, then it has failed miserably. In 2009, its failure brought demands for an audit of the Fed and possibly for its abolishment. Because no government audit of the Fed has been allowed since its inception, there has been no way to examine the Fed's true operating expenses or activities. As far back as 1975, consumer advocate Ralph Nader asked, "Since other departments of government, including the Departments of Defense and Treasury and other agencies that regulate banks, have long been subject to the audit of the General Accounting Office, or GAO, the investigative arm of the Congress, why has the Federal Reserve been excluded?" The answer is found in the secretive mixture of big power and big money of the banking Goliaths and their Federal Reserve servants that for decades has kept such matters away from both the public and Congress in order to retain their unperturbed control. No matter how obscure the functions of the Fed are to the average citizen, according to Nader, its decisions and policies affect the level of inflation unemployment, home buying, consumer credit, and other prices consumers and workers must bear. It also adds up to how few or how many financial corporations will dominate the economy. Despite Nader's support, as well as the backing of savings and loans institutions, credit unions, and some small bankers, a bill to provide for annual congressional audit of the giant Federal Reserve System was never passed in the 1970s. Nothing much has changed more than 30 years later. Explanations that come from the Internet of how the Fed operates almost always come from government or Fed sources. Nevertheless, efforts have continued to rein in the Fed. On the pro-business site Forbes.com, Texas representative and dark horse presidential campaign contender Ron Paul wrote in May 2009, "One of the fallacies of modern economics is the idea that a central bank is required in order to keep inflation low and promote economic growth. In reality, it is the central bank's monetary policy that causes inflation and depresses economic growth. Inflation is an increase in the supply of money, which in our day and age is directly caused or initiated by central banks." After noting the crumbling economy, Paul observed, "The necessary first step to restoring economic stability in this country is to audit the Fed, to find out the multitude of sectors in which it has involved itself, and, once the audit has been completed, to analyze the results and determine how the Fed should be reined in. Proposals to push the Fed back into the shadows, or to give it an even greater role as a guarantor of systemic stability, are as misguided as they are harmful." On February 26, 2009, Ron Paul introduced Bill H.R. 1207, stating, "Serious discussion of proposals to oversee the Federal Reserve is long overdue. I have been a longtime proponent of more effective oversight and auditing of the Fed. Since its inception, the Federal Reserve has always operated in the shadows, without sufficient scrutiny or oversight of its operations. While the conventional excuse is that this is intended to reduce the Fed's susceptibility to political pressures, the reality is that the Fed acts as a foil for the government. Whenever you question the Fed about the strength of the dollar, they will refer you to the Treasury, and vice versa. The Federal Reserve has, on the one hand, many of the privileges of government agencies, while retaining benefits of private organizations, such as being insulated from Freedom of Information Act requests. The Federal Reserve can enter into agreements with foreign central banks and foreign governments, and the GAO, the government's General Accountability Office, is prohibited from auditing or even seeing these agreements. Why should a government-established agency, whose police force has federal law enforcement powers and whose notes have legal tender status in this country, be allowed to enter into agreements with foreign powers and foreign banking institutions with no oversight, particularly when hundreds of billions of dollars of currency swaps have been announced and implemented, the Fed's negotiations with the European Central Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, and the other institutions should face increased scrutiny, most especially because of their significant effect on foreign policy. If the State Department were able to do this, it would be characterized as a rogue agency and brought to heel. And if a private individual did this, he might face prosecution under the Logan Act. Yet the Fed avoids both fates. More importantly, the Fed's funding facilities and its agreements with the Treasury should be reviewed. The Treasury's supplementary financing accounts that fund Fed facilities allow the Treasury to funnel money to Wall Street without GAO or congressional oversight. Additional funding facilities, such as the Primary Dealer Credit Facility and the Term Securities Lending Facility, allow the Fed to keep financial asset prices artificially inflated and subsidize poorly performing financial firms. The Federal Reserve Transparency Act would eliminate restrictions on GAO audits of the Federal Reserve and open Fed operations to enhanced scrutiny. By opening all Fed operations to a GAO audit and calling for such an audit to be completed by the end of 2010, the Federal Reserve Transparency Act would achieve much-needed transparency of the Federal Reserve. National polls indicated deep and widespread public support for Paul's proposed audit. A mid-2009 Gallup poll showed that only 30% of those surveyed thought the Fed was doing a good job. Additionally, a Rasmussen poll stated that 75% of respondents wanted Congress to audit the Fed. Taking these poll numbers into consideration, the passage of legislation to audit the Fed is a litmus test to see who wields more power in the United States, the people or the banking interests. As of February 2010, Paul's attempt to pass legislation to audit the Fed had gained 319 co-sponsors in the House and 32 sponsors in the Senate, where it was known as the Federal Reserve Sunshine Act of 2009, S-604. In early 2009, H.R. 1207 was referred to the House Committee on Financial Services, chaired by Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank. In a letter to a constituent, Frank wrote, "I agree with the general thrust of Ron Paul's bill. There have already been some moves forward in increasing the transparency of the Federal Reserve, and I agree that there are further steps we can take. I do believe that the Federal Reserve is exercising that power with some good effects recently, but it is not a power that should exist in a democratic society in the hands of an entirely unelected entity." On July 6, 2009, South Carolina Republican Senator Jim DeMint attempted to amend the Legislative Branch Appropriations Act by adding the entire text of Ron Paul's bill, but he was stopped by senior Nebraska Democratic Senator Ben Nelson, who said the amendment violated Senate Rule 16, which prevents tacking legislation onto an appropriations bill. After DeMint pointed out that other GAO audits in the appropriations bill violated Rule 16, Vice President Joseph Biden, who also is president of the Senate, agreed but took no action, and the bill passed without the amendment. After two readings, S-604 was referred to the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs in March 2009. On November 19, 2009, the House Committee on Financial Services approved an amendment to the Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009, H.R. 3996. That included many provisions of Paul's bill, such as the removal of some GAO audit restrictions and review of Fed policies and agreements with foreign institutions. This amendment was opposed by Fed Chairman Bernanke, Treasury Secretary Geithner, and other Obama administration officials. After further changes to the amendment, including a provision that provided for audits of the Fed's balance sheet but not its monetary policies, in December, the Financial Stability Improvement Act was combined with several other financial bills to form the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2009. Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009, H.R. 4173, which was passed on December 11th in the House with a 223-202 vote. No Republicans voted for the bill, including Paul, who apparently saw this combining maneuver as an attempt to water down his original audit proposal. Paul's vote apparently was especially addressed to those who continued to support a hands-off attitude of the Fed, such as Forbes columnist Thomas F. Cooley, the Paganelli Bull Professor of Economics, and Richard R. West, Dean of the NYU Stern School of Business, who writes a weekly column for Forbes. In a spring 2009 Forbes column, Cooley argued that it is important to have an independent central bank. An independent central bank can focus on monetary policies for the long term, that is, policies targeting low and stable inflation and a monetary climate that promotes long-term economic growth. Political cycles, alas, are considerably shorter. Without independence, the political cycle would subject the central bank to political pressures that, in turn, would impart an inflationary bias to monetary policy. Politicians in a democratic society are short-sighted because they are driven by the need to win their next election. This is borne out by empirical evidence. A politically insulated central bank is more likely to be concerned with long-run objectives. Cooley quoted a Ron Paul statement that, "Auditing the Fed is only the first step towards exposing this antiquated insider-run creature to the powerful forces of free market competition. Once there are viable alternatives to the monopolistic fiat dollar, the Federal Reserve will have to become honest and transparent if it wants to remain in business." In response to this, Cooley wrote, "Great, Obviously, monetary policy is so falling off a log simple that your elected representatives can insert themselves via the demand for transparency into decisions of true complexity and subtlety. Why am I not feeling reassured? He added, anything that threatens the independence of the Fed threatens the long-term viability of monetary policy. It is really important that the expanded role of the Fed in the current crisis not threaten that viability. But does that viability include secrecy and arrogance?